All right. So I'm Christian Bird. I'm happy to welcome Claire. Claire Legues is an assistant professor at CMU. She was actually an intern here at the year that I was many years ago. That's where we met. And has had quite an illustrious career since then. She's done work on genetic program repair that's received many awards. It's a really active line of research that she's kind of inspired other people to take up as well. So she's done a lot, doing very well at CMU. She'll be here for the rest of the day. I don't know how busy her schedule is, but if you'd like to chat with her and you're not already on her schedule, email Tom Zimmerman. He'd be happy to try to work with you to meet with her. So with that said, Claire, we're so happy that you came and visited us. We're looking forward to what you have to say.
Thank you, Chris. And thank you for the really unnecessarily kind introduction. And thank everybody for listening, both here and remotely. It's really great to be back at MSR. Actually, about 4 days before I left for Seattle, Phil Guo sent me this because he dug it up from the 2009 RISE intern cohort year. And I just couldn't help myself. I had to include it. We can kind of play like spot the researchers now. Jean Yang is missing, but you'll notice people like Santosh Nagarketty, Cindy Remote, Rubio Gonzalez, Phil Guo, whole bunch of people. So I thought this was funny. I'm in there with my grad student haircut. Couldn't help myself. Sorry about that. That is one of two silly slides in this talk. So I'll be talking today about some work that we've been doing in my group at Carnegie Mellon on scalable semantic code search for high-quality program repair. Before I tell you about that, I must acknowledge the incredible work and contribution of my graduate students, especially Afsoon Afzal and Renard Ben-Tonder, to whom all of the real credit for any kind of technical interest novelty is due, because they are amazing, and I couldn't do any of this without them, as well as my collaborators and co-PIs, Katie Stoley at NC State and Yuri Brun at UMass Amherst, and of course their amazing students as well, and the NSF, because they're the ones who fund the work. So normally, I would begin this kind of talk with a set of facts and figures about the importance of software quality, about the expense that bugs represent to the overall global economy, about the problems we face with security when it comes to defects in software, and how we really need to address that problem. But I kind of trust this audience to believe me. So imagine I showed you that slide, and instead I want to situate this work and lay out the problem domain in a fairly concrete way, just so you know what exactly it is that we're targeting. And I'm going to do that by telling you the true story of why I went to grad school, and I'm thinking it should definitely resonate with the Microsoft context, because it involves being a software engineer, which I was once. Once upon a time, story. I was young. This is me, I'm young. I did not get a PhD right away. I got a job as a software engineer at a large company. It was not Microsoft. I worked in a division of this company that had an existing product, and it had a number of customers. It did a number of things already correctly. It had features. We sold it. It also had associated with it, as is pretty normal in a development context, processes and artifacts that were used to assess and evaluate its quality as it evolved over time and as we added things. So for example, it had a regression test suite. It took 18 hours to run in its entirety, which at the time blew my mind. Now is maybe less mind-blowing, but as I said, I was young. And one of the process features that we used to maintain and evaluate quality and improve it over time is that we were all on 6-week bug duty rotations. So that meant that once every 6 weeks, we were assigned a bug, either a regression or a set of test cases that were failing, or a bug report either internally or externally reported, and we had to fix it. The bug report that sent me back to grad school came from a customer. And it's specifically related to our mishandling of the 64-bit Unicode standard for the Ukrainian Cyrillic alphabet. It took me 3 days to fix, that I will never, ever in my entire life get back. I'm going to spare you details, because it's really the use case that matters. The Unicode details are fairly boring. So this is the fundamental problem that we're targeting in research in automatic program repair. We have a program that exists. It's doing many things correctly, but at least one thing incorrectly. Now, of course, in the wild, there are many ways to validate or assess whether a program is behaving correctly or incorrectly. In research practice to date, although I will revisit this assumption later, we have been using test cases to witness desired behavior. So when I say that there is a bug that we'd like to fix, I mean that there's a test case that's failing. In the wild, in practice, I was tasked with constructing a small set of changes, typically, many bug fixing patches are small, that corresponds to a patch that when we apply it to the input program, results in a very similar program doing the correct thing for that previously failing test. I shouldn't break anything, usually. The goal in automatic program repair research is to develop methods that can produce those types of patches automatically, freeing developers like me from 3 days of Ukrainian Unicode standards. Now, typically, I'm going to be hand-waving over a lot of previous work, and I'm sorry. This is done by instantiating, creating, recombining, otherwise producing combinations of small sets of changes to the input program, seeking one that does the right thing. So in many ways, we're sampling the space of small patches to the input program in constrained or domain-specific or intelligent ways to accomplish this goal. Now, there are, of course, a number of high-level challenges that obtain to solving this problem well, not the least being that it's impossible, sort of trivially. But of course, impossible problems are a lot of fun, so that's OK. The challenge I'll be focusing on today is what we refer to as patch quality. So even though any patch produced by any such technique, by definition, leads a program to pass a given set of test cases, one's insulin pump likes to chime in the middle of a talk. Even though a patch will cause a program to pass in a given set of test cases, that doesn't mean that we necessarily believe that it's perfect. And this is true, actually, regardless of where the patch comes from. Humans, of course, can make bad patches all the time, but it's particularly relevant in an automated context. So for example, if we focus just on functional correctness, a patch might pass a set of test cases but introduce some backdoor that could be exploited by a negative actor. A patch might fragilely memorize a particular negative input and fail to generalize to the overall specification. It may break under-tested functionality. And these are things we'd like to avoid. Now, I think this problem of how we measure and reason about quality, of course, is unsolved so far, but we've been making some advances in how to reason about this. One way we've proposed to assess quality, at least in an experimental context, is to look at patch program behavior on a different set of tests, a held-out set of tests, that were not used to guide patch construction. And if you think about it this way, it's a machine learning problem, where the tests given to the technique are the training data. And we're going to ask the degree to which the generated patch or the model with respect to that training data generalizes to other data that was not used to construct it. And then if we do this for a number of patches produced by a given technique, we can maybe characterize the extent to which it tends to produce patches that generalize beyond the provided data. So this is much more useful, actually, in experimental context than in practice, because it assumes the existence of two test suites that are independent but of reasonable sort of quality. And since the whole problem actually is that we don't really have enough tests to start with, it doesn't necessarily solve the problem in practice, but it does provide an experimental framework that can drive the collection of information to move our progress as a field forward. So we've done this. We have a data set of buggy student submissions to an introductory programming course, which allows us to construct two high-quality test suites. And we've used that to guide bug fixing processes and then to evaluate that and see what we get out of the patches. I'm actually not going to tell you a huge amount of detail about what we found, although I think there's some interesting stuff. But I'm mentioning it because this methodology gives us a way to reason about patch quality and a way to start challenging elements of previous techniques to bug repair that may, in fact, be hindering us from making progress on producing high-quality patches a priori. So the key work I'm presenting today, I'm really going to be presenting you two sets of techniques, or two threads of techniques for program repair, each of which challenges one of those core assumptions that we think might be preventing us from achieving high-quality patches based in part on these kinds of experiments. Rishabh.
Are you going to discuss more about the setup for student program
yes.
repair?
I will come back to it a little bit because we use that data set. The question is, will I talk about the student evaluation framework? I will a little bit, possibly not in sufficient detail to satisfy you, so feel free when I come back to it to ask me more questions. So the first assumption is this. This is the second silly slide in this talk. Bug fixing patches are like kittens. Smaller is better. It is difficult for me to overstate the degree to which this assumption underlies so much previous work in patch generation, including my own, so I can make fun of it. The idea here is that if we make small changes, we're less likely to break under-tested functionality and thus more likely to produce high-quality patches. which sort of sounds reasonable on face, maybe. But once we started examining patch quality in detail, we really began to wonder. And I'll show you why through means of an example. I'll show you a buggy program, a patch for it, and some test cases, so you can see why we started to think, well, maybe not. So imagine you want to compute the median of three numbers. This is a simple problem. It has the benefit where both buggy and correct solutions fit on a slide. I'm going to show you a correct solution first. We're going to take three. This is in C, obviously. We have three integers as input. One of them is the median. Whether it's one of them is the median is controlled by one of a disjunction of conditions. So A is the median if it's between B and C, or between C and B, and so on. I'm mentioning this because there are basically six conditions, three decisions that matter to doing this correctly if we follow this paradigm. Here's an incorrect version submitted by a freshman. Actually, if we kind of ignore the double equals, they're really, really close. They're missing one of the conditions on C. You can also see this with test cases. This is a set of tests that achieves full branch coverage on that correct solution I showed you a couple slides ago. This program fails the second one. It returns 0 instead of 1 because of that missing case. So we've taken these tests and the program and given them to a number of previous approaches for patch generation. And we got a number of patches out of them. I want to show you a bad one. You don't really have to worry about understanding this if you're willing to believe me when I tell you that if we do this weird thing, the program in fact passes all of the given test cases. I'm hoping that that makes you uncomfortable because it looks weird, because it is weird. The other way we can see this, though, is with a second set of tests. So here are the tests that were produced by the instructor for the auto grader for this homework assignment. The original program also fails one of the tests. It's the same case that led the previous failing test to fail. But if we take this patched version, which does pass all of the provided test cases, it in fact fails two tests in the instructor provided test suite. So we can see now how this patch is overfitting to the data that we gave to the technique and fails to generalize to the implicit specification that that test suite is supposed to witness. It's actually made the program worse, which could be demoralizing if you were not an optimist, which I am.
So yes. Just to get the context, so is the test case, like when I think of unit tests, they have an assertion in there.
Yes. So there's an implied.
Right. So in your case, it's an input-output example.
Yes.
Okay.
So there's that. I apologize. There is an implied check against the expected output on these test cases. So this is failing because it'll return. No, honestly, I don't know. B is less than A. It'll return 8 instead of 6. Of course, there are many reasons this might be happening. Small changes, it's not the only necessarily the problem, right? It could be a lot of things, but it sure looks funny that we're making small tweaks to this buggy program with respect to single dynamic execution witnesses for correctness. You know, it's really beginning to look a little bit funny. And in fact, when we started looking at the implications of overfitting as a framework for reasoning about patch quality, I went back to machine learning literature and learned that for at least 30 years, they've known that the size of a learned model is not necessarily related to the degree to which it overfits, which can be a little bit unintuitive, but it's actually quite well established that the two don't have a heck of a lot to do with one another. So there's really no reason to believe at all that the size had to do with overfitting in this respect. And so maybe small changes are at least not even the solution. Maybe they're the problem. Because if you think about it, this is a ridiculous thing that we're trying to do. Like, we want six lines of code that compute the median of three numbers, right? Like, if you go to GitHub and you search median three numbers, you get 25,815 code results in C alone. Now, this is not a scientific study. I didn't actually individually count the unique appearances of correct implementations of median. I'm just saying that, you know, there is a lot of redundant code in the world. And many programmers who wrote median, we can assume, did it correctly. I think that's fair. So what if, instead of trying to make small changes with respect to an input program and a set of test cases, we instead tried to replace slightly larger buggy regions of code with code that we believe correctly captures the overall desired logic? Because a programmer who's writing a block of code, for example, she has an understanding of the implicit specification. So maybe we, if we grab a larger chunk of code, we can get that intuition that she's encoded in the sequence of statements instead of just trying to flip expressions, for example. So the principle that underlies this work is that we want to use human-written code to fix programs at a higher granularity level, and that might lead us to find better quality repairs if only we had a way to find the code. So that's the principle behind the technique we called Search Repair, which uses produces high-quality automatic patches using semantic search. We have some initial results published in ASE of 2015. I will walk you through a subset of those. We have made various technical advances since then to scale the program, scale the approach, and improve its expressive power. We are currently preparing those results, so I will give you a couple of examples from the more recent work, but I can't give you a full table. So we'll sort of see a progression of the work, some old results and some new results. So by semantic code search, I just mean search for code based on some specification of what it's supposed to do, rather than just keywords. So on GitHub, I said median three numbers, it's a keyword search. I don't know what GitHub's doing under the hood, but I didn't specify, for example, input-output examples and have GitHub search based on that. There are various ways to specify what code should do. We're using input-output examples in this work. We're building on some prior work by my colleague, Katie Stoley, where she originated this kind of code search some years ago. We reuse it, but we've made various extensions, first applying it to C, improving expressive power and efficiency, and so on since, and contextualizing it to this domain. So here's a high-level picture. We're going to take as input a program and a set of test cases, at least one of which is failing. That's very similar to the original paradigm. The first step is to localize the bug to a particular buggy region that we are going to try and replace. Quite a bit of the work in certainly heuristic program repair of the variety that I've been characterizing will just punt to existing work in spectrum-based fault localization. So look at program behavior on the input tests and compute various scores or ranks or probabilities that that they associate with program entities, saying the likelihood that that entity is associated with the fault. We do something extremely similar, except when we get from the spectrum-based approach a ranked entity, the highest ranked entity, we will expand that from that single entity to a larger region that surrounds it. We're doing this very heuristically. We're shooting for about 3 to 7 lines of code that's contiguous in some meaningful way. And we're doing 3 to 7 lines because that is the size that empirical studies of redundancy in open source code indicates is about reasonable if you're looking for semantically or at least syntactically redundant code. So the question is, you know, at some point, code that we write becomes unique with respect to the global body of code that's available in the world. But between about 3 to 7 lines of code that you write, someone else has probably already written it. So that's our intuition. We want to drill down a little bit on that assumption, but we haven't yet, but we will. So then the next step is to generate a profile that we use as a set of queries as input to a semantic search engine. To understand that, you need to understand the semantic search part. So I'm going to talk to you about that and then tell you how we get the queries. The key idea here is that we're using SMT solving to match snippets with examples. Start by encoding a database of candidate snippets as symbolic constraints. We get that from symbolic execution. So we are encoding loop-free snippets for the time being. We can fix bugs in programs that have loops, but we won't insert code that uses loops. So we're not as constrained as you might think. I actually think we can relax this assumption a little bit because it turns out that this symbolic representation can be very over-approximate with respect to what the snippet actually does. At least we've seen that anecdotally, but we haven't yet. Step two is to find somewhere input-output examples, either from the user or from some kind of analysis, that show what the desired code should do. And then you're effectively seeing which symbolic constraints are co-satisfiable with the constraints imposed by the input-output examples. And that's an SMT query. I'll drill down to this a little bit, because there's some detail there. So pictorially, you know, this is a search. We have an input. It goes to a search engine. It matches against a repository and produces some set of results. That repository is going to be a set of snippets, which we associate with a description of the variables that are used and are serve as input in those snippets. It doesn't actually have to be functions, but it's prettier this way. And the result of symbolically executing that snippet and collecting the path constraints that describe basically everything that could happen in that snippet in terms of symbolic representation of the inputs. So given that, we now need the input to the search. We get that with a dynamic analysis, and one of the world's easiest dynamic analyses, I think, capturing the types and values of variables before and after the buggy region we want to replace. So here are our inputs. We're going to do this over all passing test cases. I'm just going to show you one because it's not hard. So the input here, A is 6, B is 2, C is 8, result is undefined. Output, A, B, C don't change. result is now 6. We do that for all test cases. You have a bunch of input-output examples. We're doing it for the passing test cases because we're trying to capture what the code should do. And we know that on the passing test cases, it's doing the right thing. So that's helpful. I'll revisit this, though, in a second because it breaks down at some point. But for the time being, play along. Mike.
What do you do for how much do you capture, like, first method calls or
so we're doing
operations? So how do you know how much to capture in the input and output?
So we are looking at variables that are used in the region, and we're actually running it.
Okay.
So to be a little bit more precise, variables that are used and that are then live afterwards. So if you change a value but it doesn't matter, that we will typically ignore.
Heap involve pointers and
So we do capture the values of pointers. Basically, any variable that is written to or read from in that region, we're just going to print out its value before and after the region, including structs, actually. But we print out structs as a sort of a byte encoding of the memory region instead of, you know, breaking down fields. Chris?
So for your output, you have A, B, and C, but in this case, aren't those essentially, they're like not live, like they're not used anymore.
Right, so either that or, I apologize, I was unclear. Live is defined as live after or used in the snippet.
Okay.
Thank you for pushing me on that because you said a falsehood. So that's the input. I only show one again because it's simple. And we're going to express the input-output query as part of an overall query to an SMT solver, asking if a particular snippet matches. So for every snippet we consider from the database, and we can heuristically filter, but just imagine we try all of them, we have one element of the query that symbolically over-approximates what it does in terms of path conditions. That's the first part of the SMT query. The second part are the constraints imposed by the input-output examples. And the third part is an extra element of the query that we have to construct that maps the variables that are used in the buggy program to the variables that are used in the potentially fixed snippet. Which is to say, this lets you find pieces of code that may use different variables but could be renamed to affect the desired semantic change, as was happening here.
So will you try multiple mappings then for the same snippet?
The question is, do we try multiple mappings for the same snippet? And the answer is no. And I could tell you why in a second. We encode that mapping query in a very particular way that lets us get this answer with one query, although the first time we tried this in our first prototype, we tried multiple mappings. The nice thing about this new way is that it is a lot faster. The first implementation, we tried all permutations. And that's one of the key technical novelties, actually, that's letting us scale, is a way to do this in one query. So I don't have the time to break down the whole thing. I'll break down a couple of elements of this to give you some intuition. The examples I've been showing you are student code. It turns out that there are lots of things that students don't do that make symbolic reasoning complicated. Students don't tend to use pointers. Students don't tend to call complicated, uninterpreted functions. I have found, like I said anecdotally, that precision of the symbolic execution when it comes to characterizing the potential fix code is not that important. We have managed to fix bugs in student code based on snippets taken from the Linux kernel with a very naive symbolic execution engine that we wrote in like 2 days, just getting a massive static over approximation. But if you're trying to fix code that actually uses things like pointers or structs, for example, then you need to be able to characterize them precisely because you need to be able to map variables with those types from the buggy code to the code that might replace that region. Fortunately, people are doing great work in symbolic execution, and we can generally just appropriate their approaches for this to do this as precisely as possible. And so I won't talk about it too much more, just saying everything that they hand us, we are trying to make use of in the sort of global scientific sense of handing us. But to talk a little bit about some of the more search repair specific elements of this query, this is the question basically that Chris just asked. This mapping, how do we do this? Are we trying all possible permutations, for example? The insight here is that we are appropriating and adapting a technique for input-output guided component-based program synthesis to this domain. So this is work, actually, that Sumit Golwani and collaborators produced in 2010. It's been adapted for repair in a slightly different context. We're using it here with some slight modifications to result in an efficient mapping query. The problem in synthesis is this. We have a bunch of examples for a function and some components that we can build it with. We conduct the synthesis by constructing an SMT query that maps a desired function to a set of locations. So if a program is a set of lines, and on each line there is some kind of expression or computation performed, the question is there a way to map those pieces, those components, and their inputs and outputs to lines in the program such that we get a function that does the right thing? We're using this in the following way. In the synthesis problem, you might have a number of possible components. In our repair problem, we only have one, and it's the candidate code snippet. And that insight, the location variable insight that allows the synthesis problem to work, we adapt it to find the mapping between snippet variables and the buggy context variables. There are a couple of subtleties here. So for example, everything that's used in the snippet needs to be mappable to something in the context. We can't insert code that will have undefined variables. But it's not necessarily the other way around. You might replace a buggy region of code with a new snippet that uses fewer variables. Maybe you stop using one, it doesn't matter. So that's one direction of the mapping. There are two elements of this that were a little bit harder, one being that we need to generalize across multiple input-output examples in a single query. The second being that we capture all the variables that we log, we do before and after the region. So really, the output variables are the same as the input variables, but their values can change, but they don't always. And how do we actually do that in coding? The short answer is that we rename the output variables, but we link them explicitly in the query to the input variables so we know that they have this relationship semantically. I'm waving my hands on purpose to spare you the Greek. But this allows us to ask in a single query, does this candidate code snippet possibly satisfy these input-output examples? And if so, how do we do the mapping? Because the satisfying model that comes back, if the query is considered satisfiable, will tell us how to map those inputs to the outputs. So this is the point in the exposition where people sometimes ask me, well, why don't you just try all of the snippets? Wouldn't that be faster? And one reason it's not faster to try them is that this mapping is not obvious without some sort of helper machinery or reasoning. We're trying to find code that has a desired semantic effect, but translating that back to syntax is a second important non-trivial step, and this basically takes care of that for us. So there are several other challenges. I'm not going to go into a huge amount of detail. I'm going to give you some of the intuition. So for this I/O component, for example, we need to model console and logging output as possible output from a snippet, at least in C programs, because people do that all the time. The really hard part is actually this one, which is, well, I said, OK, we're capturing desired behavior in terms of the passing test case behavior. But many regions of code that are buggy don't have any passing tests that pass through them. They only have failing tests. So now what? So the real challenge here is that a failing test input provides some indication of what the program shouldn't do, but not very much in terms of constraining what the code should do. So if I say my input is 268 and the output shouldn't be 1, that describes a lot of code. What we've been working with here is what I've been starting to call, sort of in jest, sort of not really, counterexample guided query refinement. So we'll start with that very broad negative query. We'll take the first snippet that matches. And of course, the snippet needs to have a mapping, so it's not going to capture every piece of code in the database. We try it. It probably won't work, but it will give us more information about what behavior we don't want so we can refine the query. In the few examples we've tried so far, this has actually been converging fairly quickly. Faster than I would expect. So we're looking into why. But it's allowing us a way to get around this fact that in real world code, we don't always have passing test cases for a buggy region. Oh, I'm going backwards. Sorry about that. The last challenge is, what about inserting or deleting code? Because plenty of bugs are fixed by insertion. I've been talking about replacement. This has led us to an incremental approach to identifying patch regions. We try replacement first because it's try deletion first because deletion is really easy. Then we try replacement. We can't find replacement code that fixes the bug. We will try insertion, where the query there is the passing behavior at this point should be as unchanged as possible, and we should affect some kind of change in the failing behavior. So that produces a set of results, which are snippets. But of course, in the ideal case, we're searching based on only the passing examples. So maybe the code doesn't actually do what we want. And so we still run the patched version of the program on the test cases. We do that by taking from the satisfying model the renaming, substituting in, running on test cases, and this case declaring moral victory. And also practical victory. Okay, so I'm gonna get back to this question about student assignments. The first set of experiments we did were looking at this underlying intuition about the quality of the produced patches, because our goal was to fix bugs in a way that produced higher quality patches. Our first assessment of this is on small programs, those small programs I told you about before. What we have here is a data set of student submissions to a number of introductory programming assignments. They're submitting to a GitHub repository at UC Davis, actually. And for every time they submit, they receive a report that says, your program passes 6 out of 8 test cases, try again, or your program passes all the test cases. And so what we have there is then a number of submissions, typically at decreasing levels of bugginess, and a set of test cases that come from the instructor that we believe to be good, as well as an Oracle solution provided by the instructor. We can generate a high coverage set of tests over that Oracle solution, and now we have two pretty good test suites where we can use one to guide the construction of a repair and the other to assess the quality. And since that's the key validation metric here, we make some allowances for the fact that the programs are small. So we did a couple of experiments here looking at sort of expressive power, but the real important experiment is this one particular insight. So I'm just going to show you that result. We compared the quality of the patches produced by Search Repair, our tool, as compared to patches produced by 3 prior techniques in the space of heuristic, generate, and validate program repair. So this metric that I'm about to show you is going to show you the percentage of the held out test suite that the patched program passes. Recall that it does pass all of the test cases used to produce them by definition. So this is what degree does it generalize to the second test suite. So what you'll see, higher is better. Search Repair is doing very well as compared to the other, you know, doing substantially better in a statistically significant way than the patches produced by the prior techniques. My favorite fun fact about this is actually it's also outperforming the students because there's this natural experiment, right? The students are kind of doing the same thing. And students also overfit to provided test cases. The distribution is more skewed than it is for the program repair techniques. But actually, the median difference is there's no difference, which I find really gratifying. Sometimes people are like, well, I mean, come on, they're freshmen. I'm like, yeah, but like, they're humans with brains who are allowed to vote, right? So I actually think that's pretty good.
So you're happy that you can create a program to replicate freshmen, I'm not depressed that freshmen are no smarter than like programs that other programs can write?
Like I said, I'm an optimist.
Okay.
I'm an optimist. So I'm going to show you a table of bugs in programs that I don't have results for. I'm just going to show it to you to give you a sense of the flavor of the kinds of programs we're running on right now. I don't want you to be disappointed. I show you this big table and then don't give you results. Those intermediate results were very gratifying in terms of validating the underlying intuition. We're moving to these larger programs. These are taken from a data set that is now relatively well established in terms of assessing program repair techniques. These are bugs in real-world C programs taken from historically repaired bugs. I'm going to show you the first two bugs that we fixed from it. Total selection bias here, right, because we're sort of research is an iterative process. But you'll have to wait for the rest of the results because they are running on my server as I stand here talking to you about it. So here's one example from the PHP data set. It was failing a test case. I believe it also had passing test cases passing through this region. This shows you the developer fix. The developer replaced a condition controlling whether we break out of some higher level control structure. Search Repair finds and adapts this piece of code from elsewhere in actually the same file and renames things appropriately. I am always wary of comparing directly to the developer provided patch as the oracle for what a good bug fix is. But I think for these initial experiments, you know, it gives us some intuition that we're maybe doing the right thing. Because just because a developer did one thing doesn't mean that we couldn't do any number of other things. That said, I felt okay about this. Here's a second example that shows you insertion. And actually, this example is why we challenged ourselves to figure out how to do insertion. because about 50 lines later in the same function even, they have a very similar snippet of code to the one that the developer inserted, which we are able to find. We are not able to rename the string constant to match the desired error message. It's a hard problem. I think it's something we still have to think about, but I think it's a reasonable start. So hopefully the server will churn out some cool results soon. You can see some for the rest of that data set, and we can do some quality assessments as well, but I think it's a pretty promising approach so far. So that's the first assumption we've been challenging in our quest to address overfitting. I'm going to move on to a second challenge. This is fresher work. And by fresher, I mean we submitted something based on it to CAV yesterday morning. But it's challenging a second assumption, which is that tests are all we have. I want to start by saying I love tests. I love tests. Tests are by far the most commonly used QA approach. A lot of people use tests. Tests are a thing. But beyond the fact that our approaches may overfit to them in the way that I was showing you before, they can also lead to overfitting in a slightly different conceptual way. So I want to show you a bug that comes from Google's open source static analysis tool called Error Prone. Labeling it on slides is hard because you end up saying Google Error Prone Tool, and it's not clear if Google's a noun or a verb. They had a bug in this code. This resolution of this method can return null. And previously, then this function call in the return statement could throw a null pointer exception. The developers found and fixed this bug by calling this utility function that they had elsewhere in the same program. Now, of course, this also throws an exception, but this is the sort of paradigm that they wanted to use for handling errors in their code. So I believe them that they fixed it to their satisfaction. They added a test. Turns out that in the same switch statement, they made the same mistake. It took them 18 months to find and fix it. So on the one hand, maybe if it takes them 18 months, maybe it's not that important a bug. But on the other hand, it just seems so silly because we had this bug pattern appear. Why couldn't we fix it everywhere? It's a little frustrating. And one of the problems is that test cases really can only find one instance of a pattern at a time because it's a single concrete execution. So this is one piece of evidence about the ways that tests can lead us to overfit in a different way, which is to say to those bugs that tests can find. So deterministic tests, tests that can find, it's hard to test for memory leaks, for example, right? There are lots of bugs that are hard to test for. So we begin to say, well, what if we did something else instead of just using tests? And what is a repair, right? Because we've been reasoning about a repair as a transformation that improves a program with respect to a set of test cases, but it really could be improving a program with respect to any abstract domain. And we have many options for that abstract domain. Concrete execution is one of them, but we could choose another. So the work that I'm telling you about now, we're going to reason about repairs statically instead by leveraging local reasoning and separation logic-based static analysis to identify bugs and then semantically search for fixes to them in terms of their representation in Hoare-style logic in a particular program model and static analysis tool. In particular, we are building on and extending work from Facebook. They've open sourced a tool called Infer that uses separation logic to perform static analysis. So the stuff that Infer does to find bugs, that's not what we're contributing to. We are leveraging the internal representation that they use to find the bugs to then go and find patches for them. I'm going to show you a little bit of a grammar for their program model on the next slide. Bear with me. This is the assertion language over heap state as Hoare-style pre- and post-conditions using separation logic that Infer is using to find bugs in programs. This is simplified from several papers, but it should give you the idea. The important part is that assertions are split up between pure Boolean predicates that assert facts over variables in the program and heap predicates that has points to relations over program values. The important thing about so those are your Boolean predicates. That's what B stands for. I'm eliding the actual Boolean language. Those are your points to relations. The important thing about those heap variables is that we can reason about different parts of the heap separately if we know that they don't affect one another. And that's what the separating conjunction is encoding. You read that star as and separately. So the predicates over separate parts of the heap allow us to reason locally, because we don't have to worry about parts of a heap that are separate from the part of the heap that a particular piece of program happens to touch. That is the key thing about separation logic, that we can ignore heaplets or unrelated heap state when we're talking about what a particular piece of program code does. This is just the assertion language. The Smallfoot intermediate representation can also be described with the grammar. It doesn't really matter what that looks like. It's an IR. But the nice thing about that IR is that it can they have front ends to translate to it from multiple languages. So you can actually run the infer tool on Java and C, and I think Objective-C, although I might be making that up. Then you just need to translate back to your source language if you happen to be generating patches automatically using it. The actual analysis that they do is by reasoning about individual program commands symbolically, updating symbolic heap. And they can do this at scale and find lots of bugs that are kind of fun. So the static analysis, that part of the static analysis we focus on, looks just at bugs due to faulting heaps, null dereferences, resource leaks, and memory leaks. Their framework is actually extendable, but we started here. And these are the kinds of bugs that we're targeting in this work. That's the infer logo. That's why it's on the slide. So we say that a bug here is an interpreted command. That's just a statement. Think about it in a program. That has some heap configuration that leads the static analyzer into a special state called fault. So if it ends up in a state called fault, that is a bug. And we want to make that not happen. I will show you an example. Here is a piece of code in the sysdat project. After this if statement, if it returns null, then the program returns without releasing that file resource. So the analyzer will analyze this if condition, end up in this state, and then reason about what happens at the return given that heap state. So it says, well, if I return with this file handle being open, that's an error, and it prints one out. So the goal in a repair is to find some new command that I could insert there instead before the return that will avoid that fault state. We're restricting attention just to repairs that insert code for now. First, because you need to scope the problem. But also for these kinds of bugs, actually adding code is often a reasonable thing. If you want to avoid a null dereference, if you want to avoid a memory leak, you probably want to insert something like free memory. It's kind of a reasonable thing to do. And we say that a repair is a code that we insert that leads the program to not enter that fault state. Or more formally, that it preserves a fault-avoiding interpretation. So then what we're looking for is just a repair that does that. So we express a repair specification as a query. We are looking for a command, that's what CR is, that moves us from the bad heap state to a fixed version of that heap state. Precondition, postcondition, command does a thing. So if we want to close a file resource, we want a command that will transition us from a place where that file resource is open to a place where it's closed. That R is actually not referring to a concrete program variable, sort of an abstract idea, like we need to move from some abstract program variable var being open to a place where that same thing is closed. For now, we are providing the specification of what a fix looks like. We're saying, like, if you run into a bug because a file resource is open, the way you fix it is by closing it. And this is what that transition should look like. But I think we can actually infer this automatically. But my student said something like one thing at a time, which was possibly fair.
Yeah, so just to clarify, probably you said it. So this R close infer does not give you the correct spec. Right? You write
no.
Yourself.
Infer knows what the incorrect spec is, which is that if I get to a return with R being open, that leads us to fault. Infer doesn't say you fix it by inserting close. If they did, probably easier actually. Mm-hmm. But so that's the part that we're specifying manually for now. It does cover a whole class of bugs, though. It's not like you say for this particular bug. You do close. We're saying any bug that's caused by R being open, you fix by closing it. I think we can infer this, but we're not yet. So that's basically, this is what this query looks like, right? We're looking for a transformation we insert into the program that leads us into this transition state. The problem is that we're searching over existing code for the same reasons we were before, and maybe we might not find code that matches the exact repair query, right? We might, for example, find code that maybe they have this special closed resource handler that has this logger that's created on the heap, which means that the heap state of what that command does will not perfectly match just close. And we've seen actually quite a bit of custom handling for resource management. People write wrappers like this all the time. So what we want instead is to relax the repair query, to let it, the match code, do other things, if that's all we can find. The idea is maybe first this will let us capture pieces of code that do other things that are cool. And second, that even if it does something bad, at least we can explicitly tell the programmer, like, listen, we know that this command does this one good thing. It also does this other stuff. But we can be very clear about that, and there's not going to be a whole lot of ambiguity. Like, who knows what this patch does? Like, we know exactly what it does, and we can tell them that. So how do we do that? I'm going to hand wave a little bit and say we do that by using frame inference, which is the workhorse of separation logic. Frame inference is how we do local reasoning and find bugs using this logical mechanism. The analysis is already supplying the heap assertions that a particular program fragment affects. It's called its footprint. One of the reasons it's called small foot, I'm talking about footprints all the time. And traditionally, we use the frame inference procedure to figure out what part of the heap a command does not affect. That's what it does. But if, instead of reasoning about a large specification and the global heap, you do frame inference with respect to the footprint of a command and just the specification encoded in the repair query, the result you get from this is either that this entailment doesn't hold, at which point the fragment won't fix the bug, or you get a separation logic formula that satisfies the repair query, both pre and post condition, and separates out the fix effect from the extra semantic effects of the command, which is cool because that's exactly what we want. So, for example, world's easiest close, right? This will match, and it has no additional semantic effects. My computer's turning off. Oh, that's too bad. That was unexpected. Apologies. Now, this is the world's easiest example, actually, because it is a call that does exactly what we want on a variable with the correct name. So it's sort of a bad example in that respect, because all of the, I'm showing you a bunch of syntactic examples. But this is all over a semantic representation of that syntax. So what we actually need to do is translate that small foot representation of a command back into source code and rename the variables appropriately. The actual translation into code is not so bad, because you can always do that. They have a decidable algorithm for going back to the original code. The actual renaming we do by adapting a framework for soundly linking program fragments to this domain, and it figures out how to do the renaming for us. Handwave, Cardelli 97, adapted to program repair. And I want to emphasize that because it's important that we're separating out the reasoning about the semantic effects from the actual syntax that you need to apply to the program. We're trying to find the code that does the right thing, but it's non-trivial to figure out how to actually put it in a patch. So that last part matters. But I'm not going to tell you how we do it. I'm going to show you the reason this work excites me. About a week ago on Slack, I get a link to this from my student. This is a pull request to the Swool project, which is one of the most popular Java projects on GitHub right now. And it's really just an insertion, I think, to a file handle free, which is one reason my student was like, well, it's not that exciting. I mean, we're inserting one line. And you know, but what had happened is that he had used infer to find a bug in this project. He used his tool to synthesize a patch to that project. And then he thought, as a good citizen of the technical community, well, look, I found a bug, and there's a patch. I should submit a pull request. So he did. And they merged it, which you think, well, OK, that's cool. But given the way that program repair research has been done over the last 5 to 10 years, based entirely on test cases, this is extremely unusual, in fact, because most of our evaluations have been done on previously identified bugs for which we can find test cases by looking historically through the source control repositories of existing projects, which is fine. I'm not indicting the program repair community, but it means that we don't tend to find patches for previously undiscovered bugs, because that hasn't been our evaluation methodology. So the fact that we have been finding patches for undiscovered bugs and developers are accepting them with a thank you was really exciting for me, because that it suggests a new way of interacting with sort of the technical community and evaluating impact. And we're actually making software better, and that makes me happy, since that's the original goal. I'm going to wrap up quick with a table. This is actually probably not the most recent iteration of the table. because I didn't get a chance to pull the last thing out of the CAB submission. But this is programs in both C and Java. We went looking at popular projects that we could build with infer, where we could find bugs, with different types of bugs that we've addressed. The exciting thing about this table is that it's the same tool targeting programs in multiple languages, which also, to the best of my knowledge, is a first in this domain, or at least it's very unusual, even if other techniques do it. We can't fix all bugs for a number of reasons. Of course, there are always limitations. But we have found a number. Everything in bold is a program in which we found a previously unreported bug and synthesized a patch for it. And we do it in under 5 minutes apiece. So that's pretty cool,
so,
I think.
You say you found a bug. Exactly what do you mean by you found a bug?
Like, I mean infer found a bug.
Infer, okay. So you ran infer over the tool.
Ran infer over the tool. Infer finds a bug, and our tool
steps in and synthesizes
a patch for it.
Okay, cool.
This does not mean that they all have pulled merge pull requests, since that pull request is not part of the evaluation. It was just my student being like a good person. But it's patches that we've synthesized patches to previously unreported bugs.
So sometimes infer reports false alarms, right? Because it doesn't know the entire program semantics. So would it still consider a patch for those alarms?
That is, I think we haven't seen any in practice. But that doesn't mean that we can't. So that is a good point. There are false alarms that are possible. Infer is interesting because they include a number of heuristics to reduce the incidence of false positives. And it's kind of a weird balance because,
they have false alarms. I mean,
of course, everybody does. It's static analysis, right? So yeah, no. And that's going to be one of the trade-offs. Actually, a number of the heuristic choices that they make to improve performance and reduce false alarms end up complicating some of our analysis because they end up throwing out, for example, state they don't want to keep. They're like, no, we need that. It's been kind of interesting looking at the kind of the limits of an implementation of a tool with respect to its like actual theoretical underpinnings and seeing where we fit in. But yeah, that's a risk. We could try and patch bugs that aren't real bugs. I have to trust my judgment here when I say that we haven't seen any. But we need to do some more reasoning about how to handle that, because there's no reason why we wouldn't have it. Yes?
Sorry, just to follow on. Couldn't it be the case that if there was a false warning and you found a patch for it, that the resulting program could be better anyway? Because it might be just more obviously correct, even though it was a false bug.
Yes, it's possible. I mean, the question is, it's a false alarm because we can't prove that a file handle was closed, but the file handle is closed. Then if we insert a call to close, then we're trying to close a file handle twice.
I see.
And that would not be great. The question is, if I insert a second call to close, would it give a warning that I'm trying to call close twice? And I actually don't know the answer to that. But if it did, actually, that kind of solves our problem. And then we could then infer would be more confident about whether there was a bug there. And so maybe, this is off the cuff. I don't know if this will be the case. The question is, if you try and patch a false alarm, could we use the results to figure out if it was a false alarm or not? And I don't know, but it's a interesting idea.
It depends on the soundness of infer. If infer is sound, then maybe you're okay.
Maybe we're okay. And also, of course, we can miss bugs. I mean, being able to use the static analyzer to verify the modified version of the program is a nice thing.
So there's some work in sort of relative verification where we have tried verifying bug fixes Cluso and other tools.
Yeah.
Maybe you can look at some.
No, I would like to. Of course, there is work in verification that looks at repair as well. We tend to compare to some of the source level test case driven repair. But of course, there's work in verified repair as well. I don't know of recently published work that targets programs at this scale and has the full end to end. And if it exists, please tell me, because I'm not trying to be dismissive of it.
I can point you to that.
Yes. Like, I know that things along these lines do exist. So. Not that use separation logic, that's my knowledge, but this is still, I think I'm excited about this. This made my day. So I will conclude and leave time for more questions and pointers to related work and so on. Automatic bug repair, I think, has a lot of potential to at least help us understand software quality and maybe even make it better. We've been using overfitting as a lens to understand the challenges of solving this problem well and to drive the creation of new techniques that make better quality patches. I told you about two of them. Each of them challenges a different assumption. The first one being the small changes are good. That was semantic search. The second are the tests that we have. We use separation logic and the frame rule. Both rely on searching over existing code semantically in some way to find code that does the right thing and then contextualizing it appropriately by translating it syntactically. And so the takeaway from this is that I have some of the best students and collaborators in the world. And I'm happy to take all of the questions that you have. Yeah?
So just to sort of test my understanding of the second part of your talk.
Yes. And mine too, since it's very new.
So imagine I have a bug in which I'm leaking two files. I forgot to close two files before returning.
Mm-hmm. Right?
The chances of you finding a patch that closes two files is smaller.
Yes.
Than, so, but I'm wondering if the separation logic setting would allow you to decompose it such that you could look for a patch that closed one file and then apply it twice.
So yes, the short answer is yes.
Okay.
And in fact, for this first formulation of repair specifications as queries, we're only looking for a single semantic effect of a command. And so I think for now, actually, we'd only be able to find code that closes one file at a time and then compose them.
Okay.
I think we can relax that and say, like, OK, I want to have a semantic effect that we have two files and it closes two files. But then we need to have code that actually does that. And so I think decomposing it explicitly ahead of time probably makes the problem easier. But that's just my intuition. Michelle.
Yeah, so actually, the search space of these patches, are these constructed from globally over all the software in the world? Or is it, given a project, I'm going to only restrict my database to patches occurring in that project itself? Or is it
so the latter projects, we are doing the latter thing, which is to look exclusively inside the existing program. I think that there are benefits and drawbacks to that. The benefits is that it's been allowing us to find these kinds of custom wrappers that developers seem to really like to use for resource management, or even, you know, that null check thing before. Hold on, go back to Google for a second. This thing, this is the first bug we ever fixed. And it allows us to find this custom wrapper, which is cool because it, you know, there's a little bit of an interprocedurality there. It's actually kind of multiple lines that do the right thing. Full story here about actually the importance of compositionality with your analysis to find this, because without the context here, you can't realize that this does the right thing. But of course, there's trade-offs. If the correct code doesn't exist, then you're stuck. There is a world, I think, where you could use synthesis to do the right thing. I worry a little bit about synthesis overfitting at least to test cases. Maybe it wouldn't so much with these kinds of specifications, but I don't actually know. The first semantic search for program repair, we are currently searching within the same project as well. That's actually to deal with custom types, which is to say if your code uses a lot of structs, we could do the hard work of encoding the mapping and renaming of structs in the mapping query. Or we could say, well, why don't we try looking in the same program and assuming that structs that have the same name have the same type for now. And we did that because scope. I would love to see, especially the first project, expand more to a database over like all of GitHub, for example. I think that that will require heuristics to prune the search space before we start calling the SMT solver. Yeah.
I also wonder if you have a problem of constructing the corpus of patches with respect to like API evolution. So imagine that like the right, for a given API, imagine the right way to close a file is call X in one version of the API, but then it evolves so that it's call Y in some later version of the API, right?
Yeah.
So now you have to think about the program you're trying to patch, which version of the API is it using?
Yeah, it's a good question. Like,
and therefore, which corpus should you go appeal to?
Yeah, so in this latter work, it's really just the same version of the same project.
Right.
But this is a good point, like how far back we go matters in terms of correctness with respect to how various things are used in a project. I don't have any, at least anecdotal evidence of that being a problem or not, but I can definitely imagine it mattering. I worry if there's actually multiple versions of an API that appear to do the correct thing, but for some reason we prefer one or the other, maybe in a way that doesn't manifest in the heap state, and I...
Maybe I'm haunted by this because I've been doing a lot of JavaScript programming lately, and like that standard keeps shifting a lot, and so the idiom for the right way to test for null or whatever like moves around, and so you kind of have to know like what are you targeting to figure out.
Yeah, no,
what
it's a good point.
Is.
It's a it's something worth thinking about. I will mention to my students for sure. See how much we run into it. API evolution. Yeah, we're not targeting JavaScript yet. We are fixing.
Hey,
we are fixing bugs in the PHP interpreter, which is written in C, or the part of it that's written in C.
You're right. That's worse.
Which is horrible. But I have to say about the PHP interpreter is that the devs have really good discipline when it comes to documenting and inserting regression tests for bugs. They are very like methodical about that, which is a funny thing given their approach to language design, but. You know,
they're not the guys who designed the language.
You know, you have to get into a weird headspace when you're looking at patches for PHP, actually, because if you're trying to look at, like, okay, this test case is failing, and then this version of the program, this test case passes, right? And you have to try and understand why. If you look at the developer patches, you have to realize that the dominant principle is that the PHP interpreter should not crash. And there's a weird headspace, because you're like, okay, if I call substring with, like, a 16-bit character as the first argument, and like an array of floating points as the second argument, and like the empty string, it crashes. You're like, yeah, because it's like a ludicrous thing to do, right? Like, why'd you do that? But that is not the point. The point is that the PHP interpreter should not crash. So now you're the bug fixer, and you need to make a choice about what PHP should do in that case. It's a weird world that, yeah. I spent a lot of time staring at PHP code. Not actual PHP code, but like the PHP interpreter. The internet makes sense when you do that. Sorry, random rant.
All right, any other questions?
Always happy to take emails, so I'm free. Thank you, everybody, for having me.
Thanks,
and for coming. I appreciate it.